This hour, we will talk about methodology, the methods, the techniques of the modern archaeological movement, as you have just heard. Next hour that I speak, we will deal with the documents, documentary sources, and try to show you what has been discovered and do some interpretation, and then finally tomorrow on how this applies to our understanding of Scripture, exegesis. Many years ago, Professor Albright used to go around and tell the story about the Methodist Sunday school teacher who had a running debate with the Baptist, it was the Methodist Sunday school superintendent who had a debate with the Baptist Sunday school superintendent over water baptism. And the Methodist claimed that immersion was the right way, and the Baptist, of course, the Methodist claimed sprinkling, and the Baptist immersion. The Baptist man became so worked up about it, he decided to go over to Palestine and see for himself what he could prove about that, because the Methodists always said that there just wasn't any place in Jerusalem big enough to baptize 2,000 people on the day of Pentecost. So the Baptist went to Palestine, took all his savings to get there, endured incredible suffering, dysentery, was robbed, and finally found the Pool of Mamila, which is a very large pool in Jerusalem, and triumphantly claimed now that he had the evidence for a place where 2,000 people could be immersed, and no one had the heart to tell him that the Pool of Mamila was built in the Middle Ages. So if you go over to the Holy Land, you're going to find guides taking you around and telling you all kinds of things that just ain't so. So if you go, be sure you go with someone who is knowledgeable, because there are many sites that are very authentic. I just want to give you a survey of the history of the modern archaeological movement. Centuries ago, people began to dig away at places like Pompeii and Herculaneum, realizing that there were tremendous things underneath, and I suppose there's no place in the world that has excavations with the richness of Pompeii and Herculaneum, because the towns were completely buried by volcanic debris in just that almost moment. People are even found still in a running position when the volcanic ash covered them over, and the archaeologist just digs down and finds out one of these hollow places where the form of a person was, because the body has disintegrated, and they pour in plaster, and then they take it all away, and they have the actual plaster cast of a person just in the position that he had when he was running from that awful Holocaust. But we don't have anything like this, really, in the Holy Land. The Palestinian or Near Eastern archaeology really got underway in a very small way, perhaps by Napoleon, who had the good sense to send along with his expedition to Egypt scholars. And the scholars, everyone knew about those hieroglyphs that were there, but no one knew what they meant or said. Everyone thought they were holy writings, hieroglyphs, and only holy writings. So, however, the Rosetta Stone was found at that time, a bilingual that had Egyptian in both the hieroglyphic and hieratic, and a Greek text. And of course, it was through that Greek text on the Rosetta Stone that hieroglyphs were eventually cracked. In the mid 19th century, there were Bodas digging. They began to dig in a rather haphazard way, but nevertheless dig at places in Assyria, where ancient Assyria was, at Mosul, which turned out to be Nineveh. The great bulk of papyri also that was found in Egypt, because of the extreme dryness, the perishable materials remain in Egypt, and so this tremendous quantity of Egyptian papyri has come to us. The works, we don't have time to touch on anything, but just a brief survey, the works of men like Condor and Kitchener in Palestine, and Clermont-Ganneau, who found the Moabite stone or the Mesha inscription, a large inscription in old Paleo-Hebrew script dating from the 9th century. Very important, shows us, by the way, that Hebrew gives us the script that they used in biblical times and in a language, the only bit of Moabite that we have, but it proves to us that that Moabite was so close to Hebrew, so very close to the Hebrew that we have in our Hebrew Bibles, that surely the people could talk with each other without any difficulty of understanding at all. So that the Moabite stone has been around for quite a long time. There was the beginning of the Palestine Exploration Society, or its origins back in the 19th century. But it wasn't until 1890 when Sir Flinders Petrie began to excavate at a place called Tel El Hesi that archaeology really got off on somewhat of a scientific footing. And because Sir Flinders Petrie was the first one to realize that the pottery that was everywhere, you see, you can't destroy pottery very easily. You'd break a pot, it breaks in pieces, but the pieces remain. And you have to literally grind it to powder in order to destroy it. And Flinders Petrie began what he called pottery sequence dating, that is, depending on the sequence of pottery forms. He was able, at least relatively, to show that in different times, the pottery, different types of pottery were used. Now, this was a very important discovery. Then there were many others beginning in the 19th century, McAllister at Giza and Reisner, who added to what Flinders Petrie had done, the careful surveying and architectural methods and exact recording and so forth. And eventually, photography was used. Then began the Department of Antiquities of the British Mandate under Garstang, who excavated at Jericho and other places in the 30s. The American Schools of Oriental Research began in the early part of this century. Lachish was excavated, the famous Lachish letters, which are ostraca from the city of Lachish, written by Hebrew military commanders at the time of the fall of Jerusalem. I will say some more of that comes in the area of documents. Say more about that later. And then in 1929, along the coast of Syria, a farmer was plowing, and he plowed up an artifact. He plowed up something that revealed that underneath the place he was plowing, there were very important materials. And the French, who had the mandate of Syria, Lebanon at that time, began to excavate that site. And when they excavated that site, to their utter amazement, they found hundreds of cuneiform documents. Now, cuneiform was, such cuneiform documents were very common for Mesopotamia. In the tells of Mesopotamia, the cuneiform documents are just by the thousands, as we said, 200,000 just at one place in Ashurbanipal's library. But to be on the Canaanite literal, a city, or which turned out to be a city on the Canaanite literal, to find cuneiform documents was rather unusual. Occasionally, a cuneiform document would be found, even in Egypt. And of course, there was the great Tel El Amarna tablets that were found in Egypt. We'll say more about this later. But to find these cuneiform documents by the thousands, really, at a place that was called Rashamra, we find later the ancient name of the place was Ugarit. To find these things was amazing, and also on the decipherment turned out to be very easy, even though no one knew that type of cuneiform, because it was different than the cuneiform of Mesopotamia. But it turned out to be very easy, and the reason was that this cuneiform was alphabetic. Now that was an utter amazement, that cuneiform should be written in an alphabet. But here were the Ugaritic tablets, and we'll say considerably more about them. And of course, in 1947, the same way, accidentally, the Dead Sea Scrolls were at first discovered, and then many additional excavations took place. Kenyon's excavations at Jericho, and the work of G.E. Wright and Paul Laffin, Bill Deaver, and others at Gezer and at Shechem, and I'm just touching the surface. And then the work of the Israeli archaeologists Aharoni and Yadin, Masada, Aharoni at Arad, and Yadin at Tel Dan, and at Hazor. So many of these places, we must realize that what has been done in excavation, really, in the Holy Land, has been hardly more than just touching the surface. It was thought at one time that that archaeology could be carried on by tremendous grants of money that would come. Now, these days are gone forever. But back in the 30s, the excavation at Megiddo and at Beth Shan at Megiddo by the University Oriental Institute, they had a grandiose plan that they would just strip off Megiddo level by level, and they did indeed, but they still didn't finish, and they consumed millions of dollars. That kind of work can no longer be done because there simply isn't that kind of money around for archaeological excavation. But the point we are trying to make is that archaeology really has come into its own in the 20th century. The methods, of course, they use topography, that is, the study of the contour of the land, which is very important, but stratigraphy and typology are the two methods that combine that are most important. And that is that the cities were located on tells. And these tells, in the book of Joshua, chapter 11, verse 13, the King James says that the cities stood in their strength. Well, of course, the word is tell. It's a word that is not used hardly at all. I think this may be a hapax in the Hebrew Bible. It's not used very much, at least, in the Hebrew Bible. But it is used very commonly in Arabic, and it doesn't mean strength. It means an artificial mound, and it should be translated, the cities stood on their tells. And those tells are there because one occupation was upon another through centuries. And case of Beth Shan, for example, from the 7th century A.D., all the way down to Neolithic times, there are some 30 different strata in that one tell. And people might say, well, how in the world, you know, can all that be gotten into such a place? Well, because people built walls around these great fortified cities. The tells always represent fortified cities. The phrase in the Hebrew Bible is a city and her daughters. It means a city and the little hamlets that were unfortified. When the people who worked the fields and lived in the hamlets, the enemy came, they came into the fortified city. Now, it was important that these fortified cities should be located strategically, and they had to be located at good water source, because you can't last long in a siege without water. And they had to be defensible, and of course, the higher the tell got, the more defensible it got. So the higher it got, the better it was for locating a city there. And that's why they always tended to be at the same place. But the strata built up with the walls maybe partially crumbled, but the walls tending to keep in the eroded debris, and century after century, strata upon strata built up. And now the archaeologist uses stratigraphy, trying to identify the differences in strata by the color of the strata. If you run into a city that has been burned, then you have a layer of ash, very easy to identify. Watching for floor levels, and of course for walls, and identifying walls of houses or walls about the city or whatever, identifying and separating one from the other. Now, this is used, and typology is relating the different styles of the pottery, shape of the, not only the shape of the pottery, but the design or slip that might be put on the pottery, plus the material which the pottery is made, whether or not grit was used along a certain type along with the clay, I mean, how that pottery is made. I could show you a few sherds of certain very distinctive types of pottery, like Kirbit Karak ware or Nabataean ware, and I could show you one piece of that pottery, and you would never have any problem identifying that type of pottery again. Now, it's far more complicated than that, but there are certain types, very distinctive types of pottery that once a person sees it, it's so distinctive that you could identify that type of pottery if you found it anywhere. So it's the shape of the pot and all the rest. Now, locating a type, a style of pottery within a certain strata enables the archaeologist to build up a relative chronology. That is, a relative, that what is underneath of something else is presumably earlier. The problems arise when the ancients dug pits, which they often did. It went down through more than one strata. So you have to be very careful, and it takes a great deal of painstaking work to make sure that what you have is really from the strata that you think it is. So, and of course, because you find something in a particular strata does not necessarily mean that it has to be from that strata. It might be from anything later than that. For example, the archaeologist often finds scarabs. Now, the Egyptian kings had the habit of putting out editions of scarabs the way we would stamp a medallion or a coin to commemorate something, and they would commemorate an important event by putting out an edition of scarabs, these little beetle-like things made out of faience, a special type of material that they made them out of, and they would have an inscription on back. These can be identified because they often have the cartouche of the king who put them out on the back. Well, if you find a scarab in a particular stratification, that does not necessarily tell you that that stratification is to be identified with the time of that king. It merely tells you that it could be any time after the time of that king, because the people tended to hold these things as heirlooms, and they would keep them from generation to generation. And people of a far later generation might have a scarab that goes back considerably earlier. You find it in some later strata. Well, those are all some of the things that the archaeologist has to put up with. But the use of photography and, of course, architecture and architectural drawing, surveying, osteology, having a specialist come in to identify bones, metallurgy, chemistry, nuclear physics, botany, numismatics, papyrology, epigraphy. These are all things that the archaeologist has to often bring in a specialist to help him out in dealing with these matters. For example, when Kathleen Kenyon found in Middle Bronze Jericho certain tombs, and she found amazingly that some tombs had in them wooden tables and other artifacts made of wood, very rare for Palestine. This wood was perfectly preserved, showing lovely Egyptian design in these tables of Middle Bronze, and they couldn't figure out how it could be. Now, these were sealed tombs until a specialist came in and determined that some volcanic activity, and of course the Jordan Valley has lots of volcanic activity, the many hot springs with all kinds of things bubbling up. The Dead Sea has bitumen coming right up from the bottom and floating to the top. The ancients used to go and gather it up to make things out of it. But there's lots of volcanic activity there, and the specialists determined that volcanic gases got into the sealed tombs and killed off all the microbes. And so in this particular case, we had things that would normally be perishable remaining in very excellent condition. Now, we don't get that very often in Palestine. But this was one of those cases where that happened. So the stratigraphy and typology, however, are the things that you should keep in mind as being most important. It's just like we have styles of clothes today, and you can tell that people have, you know, if you look at a lady's dress, they had a certain style in the 20s, and you could identify at least that type. Now, the same thing happens in archaeology, it happens today. Styles repeat, and so more complications come in. But usually there's more to it than that, so that if a style is repeated, usually we can go to other criteria. We can look at the type of clay that a particular pot is made of, and if it isn't the same kind of clay, the same constituency, then we know that, consistency, I should say, then we know that that particular type of pot, even though it may be the same shape, it may be a revival of a style, still doesn't come from the same time. So much for the methods. Let me speak to you about how a pottery, for example, can help us identify something with regard to scripture. The city of Shiloh, we all know of Shiloh, and the city, the book of Judges tells us in Judges 21:19, where the city was located. It was the place where the Israelites located the ark and the tabernacle for some time, and the last chapter of Judges locates the city of Shiloh in a very precise way. Judges 21:19. Says, "And behold, there is a feast of the Lord in Shiloh yearly in a place which is on the north side of Bethel, on the east side of the highway that goeth up from Bethel to Shechem, and on the south of Labona." If any of you have gone over to Palestine, you can go, you can follow these directions, and you can find Shiloh quite easily by these directions. You go up the highway north of Bethel, and about midway between Bethel, Bethel is very near a modern town. The modern city of Bethel is called Beit Tin. It's a little town there, but halfway between that and the Ebal Gerizim area, you will find off on the highway that goeth from Bethel to Shechem, side of that on the east side toward the Jordan Valley, this fine ancient ruin, and it has been excavated and has been identified as Shiloh. Now, in Samuel, we're told about the ark and how the ark was there in Shiloh, and how those two B'nai Belial, as the Hebrew calls them, those two scoundrel sons of Eli, decided to take the Ark of the Covenant out of the tabernacle and go into battle the way the heathen took their idols and into battle, so they would have the idol there to the god to protect them. They thought, if the heathen can do that, we can do it with the Ark. And of course the Ark, they lost the battle, lost their lives. The Ark was taken captive, and you remember the Ichabod story, no glory. The Ark taken by the Philistines, and then caused the Philistines a great deal of trouble, and they had to send it back. But the point is that the Israelites had a tremendous defeat. This was a sad, sad day. We are not told in the biblical text here, however, that the city of Shiloh fell in that in the battles that took place. We simply are told that the ark was taken, and the text here says nothing about the destruction of Shiloh, until we get to the book of Jeremiah. In Jeremiah chapter 7, Jeremiah does speak about the fall of Shiloh. In Jeremiah 7:12, he says, "But go ye now unto my place, which was in Shiloh, Jeremiah 7:12, where I set my name at first, and see what I did to it for the wickedness of my people Israel. So Jeremiah mentions this several times. Over in 26, 6 and 7, he speaks of how God allowed Shiloh to be destroyed because of their wickedness. Here he's saying, you see, go and look at that place, look at the site, and you'll see what happened to ancient Shiloh because of that wickedness. Now, the excavation at Shiloh was very revealing, because at Shiloh, a certain type of storeroom, a jar with a certain type of rim on it, a store jug that they would put grain into, has a certain type of rim. And that rim, that jug with that type of rim, comes into, made only at a given time in the 11th century. Before that time, such store rim jars with such store rims did not exist. So in the debris that they are excavating, they find this type of store rim jug. And this is evident, it's quite evident from that Shiloh fell approximately at the time of this sad story in Samuel, or slightly after. It had to fall sometime in the 11th century. So that's one example of how the excavation can throw light on some of the biblical text. But this is a big job of evaluation, evaluating the evidence. Many times books have been published that have been based on false evaluation of evidence. And H.H. Rawley's book, From Joseph to Joshua, had many good things in it, but it based a good deal of what it was saying on excavation, on preliminary reports of excavations, which later turned out to be not so. The identification of Solomon's stables at Megiddo, well, they turned out not to be of the Solomonic period, but rather of Ahab's period, although at first they were identified as Solomonic, and they turned out not to be stables, but to be some kind of grain storage place and store city. The Bible mentions the store cities of Solomon as well as Solomon's stables. So trying to identify or evaluate what has been discovered becomes a major problem, and it sometimes takes many years to do that. I'd like to talk to you in the time that I have left about one phase. Obviously, I can't go into everything that we would like, but I'd like to just take one phase of how we go about evaluating, and I think one that would be fascinating for you is the matter of chronology. People always come to me and say, how do we really know, you know, these things happen when they are supposed to have happened? How can you really date things in the Old Testament? Well, we all know about carbon 14. And however, there are some grave questions that have been raised about carbon 14. I'm not enough of a scientist to know whether those questions are truly valid or not. And I suppose it will take time before we can say that carbon-14 is absolutely unquestioned. You know, the carbon-14 is supposed to date, at any rate, only plus or minus 100 or 200 years either side of a given date. So if it's plus or minus 100 years, you still have 200 years in which something might happen. It's just very, very broad dating. But there are some who say that maybe those cosmic rays coming from the sun that put the carbon-14 into all living things, it was not constant, and so we can't say, you know, that it's absolutely perfect in providing ancient dates. But we really don't have to have carbon-14. And a tremendous amount of very precise dating has been done archaeologically without carbon-14. I'd like to explain some of that to you. I worked on some tablets years ago that every single tablet had a date. And when I say a date, I mean a date. Day, month, and year. Day, month, and year. Like the tablet would say, 2000 B.C. No, the tablet, of course, didn't say any such thing, but the tablets did have dates, and every tablet ended with a date, day, month, and year. It would say, day one of the month Nakigal, which happened to be the name of a month, which was based on a certain menology in a given town that had a whole list of month names, were usually cultic in their about their worship of the gods and so forth and their festivals. So in the month Nakigal, in the year in which, and here's one, but there are hundreds of them, in the year in which the city of Chemosh was destroyed for the ninth time, one of the date formulas. In the year in which the city of Chemosh was destroyed for the ninth time. Or it might be in the year of the accession of the king. Or in the year after the great wall was built. Or in the year of the earthquake. Do you know where that one comes from? The book of Amos. Amos says he prophesied in the year of the earthquake. A date formula in the Bible. The only problem is, what earthquake? And that's not easy, although Amos is not difficult to date, because he also tells us when he prophesied and what king he prophesied to. So we have such things as date formula, and they are very important. We'll come back to that for a moment, but we have some other things. We have tablets that tell us, that fix dates for us. We have text. One is called the Horsabad, a Horsabad list coming from Assyria. It's an Assyrian list. The Assyrian kings had the habit of making what we call eponym lists of their kings. The first year, and this is in the nature of date formula too, the first year of the king's reign would be named after the king. The second year of the king's reign would be named after his tortan. By the way, that word is used in Isaiah 20 when Sargon sent his tortan, his second in command, the title, down to Ashdod. And the third year would be the third in important figure in the realm. Now, we have these eponym lists like this that give us this, plus many of these eponym lists also, as date formula, tell about an important event that happened in a given year. So that in a given year, I mean, there was something that took place. One such, in the Khorsabad list, and by the way, the Khorsabad list goes from the late 3rd millennium all the way down to the 8th century in different forms and so forth. But in part of that, we have places where the events took place year after year. If you're interested in this, by the way, you can go to the ANET, Ancient Near Eastern Text Relating to the Bible, the Pritchard volume. Incidentally, it's the most important volume for ancient texts like this, for understanding the Bible, that you can possibly get if you want to add something to your library. It's a tremendous cost, but if you want to really have something to go to the sources, rather than depend on what other people say, get that volume, the Ancient Near Eastern Text Relating to the Bible, and its companion volume, Ancient Near Eastern Pictures. But you can see the list there. And in this Khorsabad list, there is a solar eclipse recorded. A solar eclipse. And we have no problem at all. As soon as we find such a solar eclipse, the astronomers can go to work and tell us exactly when that solar eclipse took place in that part of the world, when there was a solar eclipse, and we can date. We turn our relative list, our relative dating, into an absolute dating. That solar eclipse took place in the year 763 B.C., and it gives us an absolute dating for the Khosabad list, so that we have this long list of Assyrian kings in which we can really date precisely when they reigned. Now, that's important, but we have another such document that is available. It's the Babylonian Chronicle. Now, the Babylonian Chronicle is not as long as the Khosabad list. It's a much more constricted period at the time of the Neo-Babylonians, and they listed the important things in the campaigns of the kings and what they were doing one king after another during the days of Nabopolassar and Nebuchadnezzar and so forth. And so we have this. Now, the Khosabad list and the Babylonian Chronicle overlap. And since we have a precise dating for the Khosabad list, this enables us to have precise dating for the Babylonian Chronicle. Now, if that were not enough, we also have the Egyptian materials. And the Egyptians were given, they were the great sophisticates, you know, in a very real sense in the ancient world. They were given to, the Babylonians watched the movements of the planets and the stars and recorded it too, because they worshipped them and they used astrology, but they recorded these things. The Babylonians, we actually have a Babylonian text that tells us about the movement of the planet Venus. This text comes at the time of the king Amisaduqa, and it fits perfectly with the Khosabad list. But let's go back to Egypt. The Egyptians watched the stars, and some smart Egyptian along the way noticed that at the time of the inundation of the Nile, which of course is very important in their country, they noticed that the dog star, or the star Sothoth, was just beginning to arise on the horizon. You know, the stars, constellations move across the horizon. And so right when that star Sothoth first appeared on the horizon, some Egyptian noticed that that was the time, around the time at least, when the Nile would be inundating. Now, the Nile's inundation didn't always happen precisely, but it always came in spring. I mean, it was generally tied to the solar year, but by watching the star Sothoth, the Egyptians, shall we say, invented, not invented, but at least the Egyptians were able to observe the solar year. They used it for their calendar. So they had a solar year, they divided their calendar into 365 days, and it's that calendar that we use with the proper adjustments having been made to this day. First the Julian calendar, and then Pope Gregory made certain adjustments. But the sad thing about the Egyptian solar year was that they were not precise enough, and they missed out. They used 365 days, but they missed the leap year. So that every 4 years their calendar got a day behind, quarter of a day, you see, every 4 years. In 1460 years, their calendar that they were keeping a record of went all the way around and came back again. And that's called the Sothic cycle. Now, the ancient historians found out. Now, the Egyptians recognized that eventually that such a Sothic cycle existed. And ancient historians, when they came to understand it, realized that they had originally dated all of Egyptian history, one whole Sothic cycle, too early. And it had to be all changed. That was a long time ago. The Egyptians had this Sothic cycle, and because of it, and because of other astrological observations of the Egyptians, we can have Egyptian dates fixed astronomically. Now, that fits, that astronomical evidence from Egyptian, when certain Egyptian kings lived. For example, the king Amenhotep IV, who lived, shall we say, around the time of Moses, King Amenhotep IV, who was also called Ikhnatan, wrote letters to these Tel el-Amarna tablets to the kings of the various kings of the city-states of Palestine and Syria and Mesopotamia. I mean, many of these letters. And so we know that they were contemporaries. If a king is mentioned in Mesopotamia, as indeed there is, Ashur-uballit, who was an Assyrian king at the time of Amenhotep IV, because letters were written between the two. So if we know the date of one, we're going to know the date of the other. They lived, they were contemporaries. And the Egyptian chronology, of course, fits perfectly with, of course, the Horsabad list and the chronology of Assyria in the case of Amenhotep IV. And the same thing can be done with Hammurabi. In the time of Hammurabi, there was an Assyrian king named Shamshi-Adad I, and he wrote letters, and we have his letters, the letters between Hammurabi and Shamshi-Adad I. Now, we had difficulty in dating Hammurabi, but we can date Shamshi-Adad very easily because of the Horsabad list, so we know when Hammurabi lived. And so that's how these things are put together, and it's interesting that the Hebrews didn't know, they weren't very sophisticated about dating. They were not astrologers, you know, like the Egyptians and the Babylonians, but they were agriculturalists. I mean, they understood the seasons, and they intercalated. The Hebrews had a lunar calendar. That meant it was based on, they watched for the lunations of the moon, and the new moon, that first sliver of the new moon, was very important to the Hebrew, because that was a time of sacred blowing of the trumpets, and so they watched for the lunations. However, the lunations of the moon do not fit into the solar year accurately. You know, they're only, 29 point something lunations of the moon a day in each total lunation of the moon. So if you get 12 of them, you always have some days left over every year. Now, the Hebrews simply intercalated, and they still do it to this day. Intercalate means they threw in an extra month when it was needed. Now they throw in, they don't just throw it in, they have a system for putting in the extra month, the second Adar, as it's called, in order to keep the calendar straight. But they didn't get themselves into big troubles over that. The Hebrews had month names. They had menologies, just like the Babylonians did. When we are told that the Hebrews came out of Egypt, when did they come out? In the month Abib. Remember that? And it says there, and this shall be the beginning of months for you, the month Abib. Well, when is the month Abib? The month Abib has to be in the spring, because the word Abib means freshly ripened barley. So it's in the month when the barley harvest comes, and the barley harvest is the early harvest, the wheat harvest is the late harvest. In the month of the early harvest, that was the month they came out of Egypt, and Moses, God said to Moses, this shall be the beginning of months for you. Now, that was evidently an agricultural menology, or at least it's part of an agricultural menology. Maybe there were other names they gave to other months. But in the Hebrew Bible, we have mostly the months numbered, you'll notice, except for that one place in Exodus where it says the beginning of months shall be the month Abib. Until you get to post-exilic books like Ezra and Nehemiah and other post-Habakkuk, and Zechariah, when you get to those books, post-exilic books, you find a whole list of month names, and if you examine those month names, which are indeed the same month names that the Jewish calendar uses today, you find that they are month names that come from Babylonia. They are actually based on the Babylonian pantheon and the Babylonian religion. And so it's quite evident the Hebrews picked up those month names when they were in exile. And that's why those names are in the Bible. But there's one other interesting point for this, on this. There are three month names mentioned in one other place, or a few chapters, and that is in the building of Solomon's temple. There are 3 month names mentioned: Ziv, Etanim, and Bul. Now, the Bible dictionaries often get this very confused, but what they should realize is that Ziv, Etanim, and Bul are Phoenician month names. And why would we expect Phoenician month names to be in the Bible? When you read 1 Kings chapter 6 and 7, dealing with the building of Solomon's temple, you realize that Solomon had Phoenician technicians. He had Phoenicians come and provide the cedars of Lebanon for the building, and the work that is done in Solomon's temple and is described for us in great detail in those chapters is Phoenician work, and we have lots of archaeological evidence of precisely the type of Phoenician work, even down to the details concerning the shapes, the lily shape of certain designs and the cherubim and so forth. This all appears in our excavations of the Phoenician sites. So that probably, and this is to me a very interesting corroboration of that passage in the scripture, probably the Phoenician technicians who were supervising the work of building Solomon's temple and providing special craftsmanship for it were also involved in keeping the records. And that's how the Phoenician month names got into the text. And the real thing that makes this even more so is that the Hebrew word for month, which you Hebrew students all know is chodesh, which comes from the new moon, it means to renew, and that's the word the Hebrews use for month, the renewal of the moon. That is not used in these chapters, but rather the word yerach, which in Hebrew means moon, but is never used for month. And that's the Phoenician word for month used in those chapters. So these are some of the things that help us to date. Now, getting back to those date formula that I was talking about, the formula is day, month, and year. And in these months, scholars have studied out the months of these Babylonian texts, and we find out that every area had its own menology. We can actually determine where a particular tablet comes from by its month name. Some of the German scholars have meticulously gone through and listed. We have all the menologies of all the different towns and so forth over centuries of time, so that when we find a particular month name, we can look up in these lists of menologies from these towns, find that month name, determine, we can tell where that tablet came from that particular menology. And we also have lists of date formula. And the date formula are worked out, tied in with this absolute chronology of the Horsabad list, so that many of the business documents and administrative documents that are dated for us with the date formula, we can date quite precisely, often down to the very day and month, year and the month and the very day. And that can go back into the second millennium, although it is true that as we get down into the first millennium, our ability to date gets more and more precise. And along with the Babylonian Chronicle, our ability to date is so precise that we can tell you the month things happened, the day they happened, in many of the events that took place, say, in the time of the Hebrew, especially the later Hebrew monarchy, the time of the fall of Samaria or the fall of Jerusalem. Well, I see my time is just about up. I was going to talk to you about how ancient sites are determined, but we won't have time for that. Once again, I would like to commend you to the Word of God in Psalm 119, verse 160, which says, "Your word is true from the beginning, and every one of your righteous judgments endure forever." There are problems in the Bible with regard to dating. The transmission of numbers was somewhat of a problem, Acharoni has found an ostraca on which we have numbers, and these numbers are in hieratic Egyptian. The city of Arad is right in the Negev. So evidently, the ancients used the same system of numbering that the Egyptians used. That is, they did not spell out numbers the way we have them in our English, in our Hebrew Bible, where it's all spelled out word for word. But they wrote them by means of strokes, and one type of stroke for 100, single individual strokes for digits, and so forth. It's very easy under those circumstances for numbers to become corrupted, you know. The amazing thing is that the numbers that we have in the Bible are as precise and as accurate as they are. There are a few texts that are very controllable, where you have a Hebrew king mentioned who was 22 years old when he ascends to the throne. The Chronicles text says he was 42. Was he 22 or was he 42? Well, it's a very simple matter, because if he were 22, he would have been 5 years old when he had his first son. So there's no big problem over some of these things.